Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host for today, Jordan Osserman, and I'm very pleased to have on the program Shana De La Torre. Shana De La Torre is a social worker in practice in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She also has a past life in academia, where she studied medieval French literature, feminist gender and sexuality studies, and psychoanalysis, and which gave her the opportunity to read for money and teach at such places as Cornell, the University of Chicago, and I'm going to totally butcher this, but the École Normale Supérieure de Lettres et Sciences Humaines in Lyon, France.
Oh, that was good.
She has published articles under her former name, Shana Carlson, in such journals as Differences, a Journal of Feminist Cultural Studies, TSQ Transgender Studies Quarterly, and the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. And her book, which we're going to be speaking about today, Sex for Structuralists, The Non-Oedipal Logics of Femininity and Psychosis, published by Palgrave, came out in August 2018. So thanks for joining us, Shana.
Thank you, Jordan. I really appreciate it. It's nice to get to talk to you.
Yeah, so as we were saying right before we started the program, we've spoken mm-hmm. before about your work, and I've been a big fan of I first came across your work from an earlier piece that you published about the potential relationship between Lacanian psychoanalysis and queer theory. So I'm wondering if, before we talk about the book itself, could we talk a little bit about your kind of academic trajectory and social work trajectory and how one led to the other and what the relationship is between the two?
Yeah, happily. That sounds good. It's funny, I guess, like, the article I think you're talking about, the transgender subjectivity one.
Yeah, that's the one.
When I got to, like, writing that, the opportunity to write that, which came about through like my A exam when I was a grad student at Cornell, that was kind of the moment where I like was able to figure out how to function as an academic, which because I finally understood like, oh, the point is to sort of focus in on something that you care about. And I just hadn't been like putting those things together. I'd sort of been going through the motions up until then. And then I encountered what seemed to me to be this enormous problem, which was what I interpreted as a lot of transphobia in psychoanalytic writings about transgender people and transgender phenomena. And that just didn't make sense to me based on my, you know, admittedly limited understanding of Lacanian psychoanalysis. So you
had been interested in studying Lacanian psychoanalysis, but came across a tendency for transphobia in the work. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And I had been kind of like galvanized by it from the beginning, which was probably the best sign that like this was going to be a lifelong problem for me, Lacanian psychoanalysis. But this was a particularly like galvanizing moment. And so that's kind of where the essay came from, was just wanting to explore that for myself, like what's going on here, and trying to understand best I could, you know, what is Lacan trying to say about sexual difference? And that, you know, that comes in and out for me, like whether or not I have a grasp on that at all. But
I feel
that's
the same.
Sort of where that, yeah. That's where that essay comes from. But then it's funny to think that, like, you know, since then I have I have also kind of happily moved out of academia and into the world of social work. And so it's hard to explain exactly how that happened, but whatever it was about that problem persists for me with looking in psychoanalysis, but I want to deal with it in a clinical world rather than an academic world. I don't know.
Is it the case then that did you start with a kind of academic theoretical study of psychoanalysis that then morphed into a more clinical interest?
Yes, I think so. That might be why I ended up making the change, because I kind of just kept hitting my head up against the same wall, which was like, I want to keep looking into this in a clinical way. And that's kind of how I'm trying to proceed now. Mm-hmm. Right. But I haven't necessarily, so my work with transgender has kind of fallen by the wayside too. Like, this was a real question I had and a real passion that I had, but it's not necessarily an ongoing piece of my, piece of what I'm working on.
I wonder, actually, if we could just visit for a moment one of the kind of key arguments of the article right before mm-hmm. we go into the book, because it does kind of reappear towards the end of the book, which is, I mean, something I'm quite fascinated by is you kind of ask this question of if Lacan has this theory of sexual difference in which masculinity and femininity are kind of divorced from biology, but have instead something to do with, well, there's been different explanations given, but an organization of enjoyment or a relation to the symbolic. If I get the argument right, you're kind of suggesting that this a description of what masculinity and femininity is about does not necessarily have to correspond to what we think of as gender. Is that right?
Yes. But that's my understanding. Mm-hmm.
What were the implications of that? I mean, what kind of got you to reach that position?
Well, I was really interested in just taking as seriously as possible the idea that sexual difference could be a position in language, that language itself would sex the subject, and that femininity would be a kind of relation not to the world of gender and all of that, but actually just a relation to how you came into being as a subject in relation to the limit or the lack thereof, which is, I think, where the book kind of picks up, trying to sort of proceed with that question. It seems to me that what Lacan forefronts in the formulas is that gender won't tell us whether or not one has masculine unconscious sexuation or feminine unconscious sexuation. Gender will have intersected with it in some way, because gender becomes a sort of imaginary manifestation of whatever it is that's happening at the unconscious level, but it doesn't necessarily, it's certainly not deterministic of what's happening at that level, and it won't have, it's not deterministic, I guess, is where I want to stop myself.
I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about that piece, which I just am kind of continually grappling with as well, is it's so it kind of opens up, I suppose, a possibility for thinking about trans and queer sexualities the possibility for psychoanalysis to have more productive relationship with that, I suppose. But at the same time, what you don't do, which is quite interesting, is you don't dismiss the notion of sexual difference altogether, or, you know, what a lot of queer theorists might be tempted to do, which is say, well, this idea of masculinity and femininity upholds some kind of binary, which we have to oppose. You kind of hold on to some idea of a two, or a split of some kind.
Yeah, I think the split is important. Yeah, and sexual difference is, you know, one iteration of that split, if not the iteration of the split that psychoanalysis, you know, can't let go of, and that we as subjects can't let go of.
So let's talk about the book. Could you just begin by saying how did it kind of come about? What was the motivation for it?
It was kind of just as this side thing that I had for Levi Strauss, I think, at the end of the day. I was lucky enough to be approached by an editor at Palgrave at a point when I had already decided that I wanted to leave academia, asking, you know, did I have something I wanted to write a book about, which is a pretty awesome opportunity to be presented with. So I tried to answer that question from the point of like, well, what would I want to do if I just wanted to do whatever I wanted to do? And turned out Levi Strauss was the answer to that question. So Levi Strauss just confuses the heck out of me. And that like has not really changed throughout the course of having written this book. But I wanted to know, like, there's something about structuralism that I feel that has been lost and is so useful. And useful particularly for the very kinds of questions that are driving us politically today, which I don't even know how to begin to get into, but that I feel that we can benefit from going back to Levi Strauss and looking at how he accounted for things like structure, the symbolic language, and where, you know, just where, I don't know, I just wanted to kind of find the places where he was doing that in a way that could function today for not just sort of your classical Oedipal subject, I guess. And I had this strong hunch that that I would find some answers to that in Levi Strauss. So it came about because I was asked, do you have something you want to write? And I thought, well, I'm going to go back to this Levi Strauss character who's been driving me a little nuts.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things that's really beautiful about the book is that you can kind of tell throughout that although it's very much an academic book and very theoretically rigorous, there is alongside it a clear engagement with clinical concerns and some kind of I suppose just way of some thinking about things that is clearly in relation to other people and clinical experiences with other people. Which is unique, I think, in this kind of literature.
Thanks. That's nice to hear. Yeah, that's true. It felt like not necessarily a very personal project, but yeah, very much so something that I was experiencing writing. And I was writing it while I was in my Master's of Social Work training. So that's probably operative there. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do a big question, which is a quite difficult one, and I apologize for it. But
okay.
what really is structuralism? I mean, how do you, or what's the kind of version of structuralism that you're trying to articulate in the book?
Okay, well, I guess my first answer is kind of the negative answer, right? Structuralism, I think, is not just the sort of Oedipal account of the origins of culture. So I guess, you know, I really liked finding this Piaget quote that structuralism is a method, not a doctrine. So structuralism, I guess, is fundamentally a way of approaching questions that can be put into any kind of scenario. And what I was worried about in sort of ways in which structuralism has been construed, particularly in, I guess, like queer theory and these kinds of things, was that there had been this kind of sense that structuralism, as I understood it, had become synonymous with what I was calling Oedipal logics, or the logics of the incest prohibition, which is the logic of masculinity in the Lacanian account of sexual difference.
Right.
And I was wanting to find out, cannot structuralism also be a methodology, right? A method, not a doctrine, that has something to do with not just Oedipal ways of being in the world, but non-Oedipal ways of being in the world. Is there not some way in which structuralism can shows us that, in fact, that's just not the complete picture, the Oedipal sort of subjectivity?
Mm-hmm. So am I right in thinking the version of structuralism then that you're that you're critiquing, or you're saying that's not the whole story, is the kind mm-hmm. of structuralism that people like Judith Butler might be criticizing?
Yeah, it really was. It was kind of a chance comment made by someone in my A exam defense, where she's, you know, that kind of started this thing for me in the back of my head years ago, when she pointed out, you know, Judith Butler and has a reading of the symbolic that seems to be Levi-Straussian. So the sedimentary laws, right? That's a kind of Levi-Straussian way of thinking about the symbolic. But was that all that was there for Levi-Strauss? That was my question. Mm-hmm. And I don't think so.
This is a criticism. I mean, just thinking about Butler's work and in that debate that she has in that book with Zizek and Laclau, where it's kind of been mm-hmm. remarked a lot that the way she seems to think of the symbolic is that to enter into the symbolic is to... that the symbolic is a place that upholds all kinds of sexual gender norms and other kinds of norms that kind of forces us to obey to some degree. Mm-hmm. And that it sounds like you're offering a different account of what the entering to the symbolic involves.
Yeah. And a different account, like, of what the symbolic then would be and what it's for. I really, really, really... liked my advisor Tracy McNulty's definition of the symbolic in Wrestling with the Angel, Experiments in Symbolic Life, her most recent book, which she defines it there as a creative process of devising new fictions. And she's looking to, you know, how she reads Lacan's rereading of Freud to arrive at that definition of the symbolic. You know, just most recently, my friends have been pointing out to me that analyst Willy Apollon's definition of the symbolic is simpler still. It is what is said. It's the field of the spoken. So, yeah, it's sort of, there's a kind of obviousness to the idea that the symbolic would be somehow synonymous with just norms, right? It just seems like, oh, this is what we live in. And we live in norms, we live in ideals, values, and prohibitions. That's another Willy Apollon sort of formulation, that this is kind of what we coexist amidst. But it also seems important to preserve something about the symbolic as a site from which we can create new things. And that's what I'm kind of trying to trace out in Levi-Strauss, too, those moments where he also brings us in touch with a symbolic where we can create anew.
I mean, I suppose this might be a tricky question, but it just makes me think, is there some reason that these two definitions of the symbolic manage to coexist? Because they're quite different. One sounds it's all about prohibitions, and the other's quite creative. So how do they both get called the symbolic?
Yeah, good question. How do they both get called the symbolic? I don't know if I have an answer to that.
It might be something where it sounds like a research question to pursue for the future. But,
It does. I mean, I think McNulty kind of deals with that a bit in the introduction to her book by talking about the becoming normative of the symbolic. So a way in which the fictions with which we live that kind of permit sort of social coexistence get tired, you know, they get tired and they're like, you know, this business isn't working for us anymore. That's when you kind of know you're living in an outdated norm.
To jump a little bit, you mentioned Willy Apollon, and he appears a few times in the book. And I've kind of encountered his name and a few other people associated with this school in Quebec increasingly. It seems like there's something interesting going on over there. Some kind of new form of Lacanianism that's emerging. So could you tell us a little bit about your experience there and what are some of the ideas that are being circulated in Quebec?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's true. Willy Apollon and Daniel Bergeron and Lucy Cantin are all the founders of this group called G-Freak. And it's situated in Quebec in Canada. And my own involvement with them has been their yearly training in Lacanian psychoanalysis, which is something that takes place every June for about a week, where they offer sort of pedagogic instruction in the morning and then kind of more clinical cases in the afternoon, all within the framework of Lacanian psychoanalysis, which they themselves have innovated through their work with people with psychosis. They have a clinic that's called the 388 that was started, I think, in 1982, where they are treating people with psychosis psychoanalytically. And in order to do that, they had to innovate. They used what they were learning from what I heard from how they speak about this, that they were listening to people with psychosis in order to learn how to reinvent psychoanalysis itself for the treatment of people with psychosis. So it is very interesting and very exciting. I'm not, you know, super knowledgeable about the 388 itself, which is such an important site for them for the production of all of their work. But I have been able to go for about, I guess, 6 years to their week-long training in for people like me, you know, academics and clinicians.
And I mean, is there something, you know, because there's, like we were just saying in the beginning, there is a unfortunate tradition in some kind of Lacanian circles of not being very friendly to, you know, concerns of LGBT people and other kind of politically progressive issues. Is there something in their reading of Lacan that has kind of that you found useful in being able to continue a commitment to issues around gender and sexuality?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I guess what I have found useful has been their kind of just their orientation as such. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the way that they are, the ethical practice that they are doing is something that has actually, it hasn't necessarily intersected with my interests in gender or queer sexuality, but it has sort of let me know. I mean, the way they, I think, would talk about it is that cultural constructions as such are roadblocks to the traversal of castration. So, you know, they have spoken about the symptom is the best thing in the human, and something like homosexuality is a symptom. So, you know, in as much as they are on the side of the human and on the side of the unconscious, then they, you know, they allow you to pursue your desire, whatever it may be, but it hasn't necessarily been a place where, for example, I have pursued interests in transgender, gender, sexuality, this kind of thing. Does that make sense? Or
I mean, I guess it's, it just sounds like it's also a sort of innovative reading of Lacan that, that gets put forward, that you also kind of engage with a bit in the book. If I understand it correctly, there's a kind of renewed attention to the unconscious.
Yeah, it's a pretty radical new reading, I think, of Kahn, and that comes from their work with people with psychosis. And perhaps one of the most important things is this kind of emphasis on the idea that the unconscious is real and it is out of language. So I think that's really interesting, and that's not necessarily always the same thing that we see in Lacan.
That's something, actually, I mean, if we can jump forward a bit to chapter 4 in the book, because there you, that's the chapter called Two Traumas, Not One, The Feminine Myth. And there you discuss a bit the idea of the real unconscious. So could you say a bit about what is the real unconscious, and how is it different from what we normally conceive of as the unconscious?
Yeah, well, the real unconscious, as I'm trying to work with it, is just, it's not my idea, of course. It's, you know, it's Willy Apollon's. It's their way they talk about the unconscious as the censored or the out of language. And so the subject of the unconscious, as Lucy Cantum, I think I quote her, one of her articles in that chapter, says that the subject of the unconscious is a real. And so the only way of accessing it is through what she calls these writings of the real. I think it's different than, as I understand it, ways in which the unconscious gets figured as this, for example, just what is repressed, what has been repressed. So what is repressed is unconscious in a certain kind of sense, but it, if it has been repressed, of course, it has been represented. So it is in language in some, it is in language, and it can be brought forth into language again. The real unconscious has some other kind of trajectory that I'm still trying to understand or learn about, but that Lucy Cantum refers to, you know, you can only access that through the writings of the real. It remains out of language. And I think that that's one of the things that the analysts of G-Fleet talk about too, that, for example, I remember Apollon mentioning, you know, and even a very good analysis done to its term is not going to exhaust the censored. It wouldn't want to, right? It's, first of all, it's impossible. And second of all, you wouldn't want to, because the censored is kind of the site of the human that is going to, that results in acts, ethical acts.
So then is it to grapple with the real unconscious is in some way, if I understand correctly, is it to kind of, have some account of its functioning without exactly being able to say kind of what's in it. Is that kind of the idea?
An account of its functioning, perhaps.
I mean, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what do you do with the real unconscious, or what's its kind of clinical implications?
I think that the analysts of G-Freak would say you take responsibility for it, and its effects in your acts and in your words. So through the real unconscious is sort of acting constantly. It's just always there acting. And what at least my understanding of the work of an analysis would entail would be to very slowly kind of construct some sort of knowledge about what cannot be said, about what is out of language. And from that site, learn to take responsibility for what one says and what one does. So that, this is really from my like attempt at understanding what they have spoken about and taught about.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating, but, let's talk a bit about actually what the other kind of big subject of that chapter and the following chapter, which is this idea of two traumas that you explore. And, I really love how you do it in part through the film, The Babadook. I don't think I've yet to see critical account of The Babadook before encountering yours. So that was a lot of fun. Given that our listeners, most of them would not have read the book, could you just say kind of very schematically, what do you mean by two traumas? What's your interest in talking about that?
Yeah, well, my sense of the two traumas it's kind of the idea of the after the fact, right? The après-coup. And it is kind of linked to the real unconscious too, because, you know, you're a person who'd be going through their day and something happens and all of a sudden, you know, in the language of clinical social work today, it's like you're activated. Right? Like something has come up. And not just any such experience could really constitute, you know, the second trauma, but just to try to give kind of a everyday example, there's this feeling that surges up. As I understand it, with Freud, what he learned through his work with hysterics, right? And I guess the case of Emma is the one that I mentioned, as I recall. There's a trauma that you experience that you only experience after the fact, or I'm not putting this very well. There's something that you encounter that when you encounter it, it constructs something else that has already been encountered, but that was never sort of encountered as such, as traumatic. And it's in kind of sort of working through the logic of the second experience that there's some knowledge that can be learned about the first experience. And another way of kind of talking about the real unconscious is that it's a trauma. So I have a feeling that I'm going to want to try to re-say all of this. But yeah, I was really struggling with what this deferred action of trauma is in Freud. And I was struggling to kind of figure out what on earth it had to do. Like, why did Levi-Strauss refer to it kind of just very briefly when he's introducing his canonical formula for myth? And I don't believe that I answered that question, but I was interested in it in part because of all of the sort of discourse today about the widespread experience of like post-traumatic stress, right?
Yeah.
For example, which is really kind of just huge in mental health in the United States, is like PTSD, PTSD, PTSD. It's everywhere. And so I was trying to understand what is going on with trauma in psychoanalysis. In the Babadook, it's a whole different thing, I think. Like, ultimately, like, I kind of am trying to make the argument that when she loses her husband in that car accident, that's like a kind of second trauma for her, that there's a reason that she, that sort of propels her into not just sort of your typical experience of mourning and loss, but into something more extreme. And I was kind of arguing that it's because something in that experience activated like the first trauma for her.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in the film, right, so we have this mother who loses her husband in the car, and then if I remember, then there's a kind of haunting in which she's sort of failed to mourn this death, but her child is kind of aware that there's something going wrong here. And then the Babadook emerges as a kind of representative of this thing that was failed, that she failed to mourn. Is that kind of so how would you understand the first trauma in this case? Or is it kind of is the first trauma sort of the same for everyone, or how does that kind of work?
Yeah, I guess the first trauma, I think, I like the way you put that. Is it the same for everyone? In a sense, it's the same for everyone in as much as it's kind of like, as much as we could call it kind of the constitutive trauma that sort of introduces, you know, the subject into subjectivity. And then, of course, though, irreducibly singular for everyone, because that is kind of, I mean, there's a way in which you could say an analysis is kind of the seeking of the language for the formula of the first trauma, and a way in which to sort of make of the first trauma something out of which one then can act ethically.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I know, there's a kind of, I suppose, ongoing debate about the psychoanalytic conception of trauma. And one of the, I guess, issues in it is if we posit this kind of constitutive trauma that is universal in some way, even if it's particular or singular to each individual, how does that relate to lived traumatic, awful experiences that people have, and does it in some way devalue that, or how do we give a proper place to occurrences of trauma in everyday life in relation to this idea that everyone is traumatized in some constitutive way?
Well, my own view would be that it doesn't devalue lived trauma, like the kind of experience that people can speak about, like, for example, the traumas that perhaps are repressed, right? Or the traumas that one does have some sort of language for, or one knows that one experienced, or one at least senses that one experienced, as averse to this kind of first trauma that we're kind of talking about here that could only ever be constructed because it is out of language. I think I've kind of wondered about that too and struggled with that too. What about just your kind of the experiences we all know about that people have gone through that are traumatic? Like, what is their link to something like a first trauma? And I think where I'm kind of have been going, in part because of how I'm understanding what the analysts at G-Freak seem to talk about, would be, even within the language of mental health today, there's a sense that like an experience is not traumatic because of, what happened. It's traumatic because of what was experienced, right? So there's already this kind of displacement from the site of kind of a particular event to the site of the experience. So there's already that's, I think, useful in certain more common ways of talking about trauma. But I think what psychoanalysis would add to that is that an experience is traumatic also not just because of the experience of it, but because of, how to put this? It's not because of the actions of some other that one experiences trauma. It's what one experiences in one's body that one experiences, that there is trauma. So in a sense, it's like you traumatize yourself. But that's not to say that there's something wrong with that or that's bad or like it's your fault. It's that, no, that like how you experience that trauma inside yourself is the site of your subjectivity. It is sort of jouissance. And therefore it's interesting and productive to look at. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's kind of a crucial psychoanalytic point from the beginning, right? Is that it's the two people can experience the same event very differently. Is it then the idea with the two traumas? Is it that the kind of traumatic experience that the person has in the world somehow harkens back to their relationship to that first trauma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could say that. That if you experience it as traumatic in the world, it's because it harkens back to that other experience.
Mm-hmm. And remind me, and just for the listeners, how do you kind of work that out through the Babadook in terms of how does she resolve the experience of that second trauma?
I think she resolves it when she looks at the monster and asks, "What do you want?" That's kind of where I think like the whole thing starts to just radically accelerate to the end. She, has been clearly in a lot of denial, would be one way of putting it, believing that this monster is coming from somewhere outside of herself, and seeing it show up in various kinds of ways, these hallucinations or these bad feelings when she goes to the police, for example, to try to say she's being stalked. But there's that moment when she just looks at the monster, the Babadook, and asks it, "What do you want?" And I think that's kind of the point at which she starts to resolve her relationship to it. She doesn't really fully resolve it. I think it's interesting, right, that she kind of keeps it in the basement. But I don't know. I don't know what to make of that.
It's so fascinating to think also, though, I think what maybe the film does so well is that it's not necessarily possible to talk about this creature as purely a hallucination or something that's in her mind, because of course it's affecting her son the entire time. And so I think, yeah, one of the things that's so interesting is how is it that a psychic problem, which seems like it should just be her own, is actually kind of spilling out into the world surrounding her.
Yes, that's a lovely way to put it, and kind of makes the connection, right, to the way in which our unconsciouses affect the people around us.
Yeah. It kind of brings to mind the sort of Laplanchian formulation of, you know, the transmission of the enigmatic signifier from one person to another. Yeah. So let's work backwards a little bit, because there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in the other earlier chapters of the book as well. In chapter two, this is on, it's called Primal Scene, Ground Zero, Levi-Strauss, Lacan, and the Wolfman Beyond the Seduction. Could you tell us what were you trying to accomplish with the Wolfman in this chapter? Why turn to him?
Yeah, I was drawn to the Wolfman because I, you know, on the one hand, that's sort of where Freud is trying to wrestle with the question, like, are primal scenes real? Did they really happen? Or are they constructions and analysis? And kind of seems to, as I recall, kind of just vacillate on that question as he's trying to work through the Wolfman case. And I guess I was interested in the Wolfman case too, because there was kind of this hint that, like, you know, there was this sort of unacknowledged or sort of unanalyzed or experience of sexual abuse that perhaps is also at play in his life, that sort of doesn't necessarily, it certainly doesn't get talked about explicitly in Freud's case with the work that he did with him. So what's going on with that? And then lastly, I guess I wanted to think about the Wolfman because I think when I was first sort of thinking about Levi-Strauss and the Wolfman, it was at a moment when I was trying to figure out, like, is there something queer about structuralism? Or, right, like, the Wolfman is a case study where we get to kind of access the fact that any kind of analysis is going to engage with what you could call queer erotics, right? Because the unconscious desire, just as Apollon points out, just doesn't answer to norms, values, ideals, and prohibitions. So it's queer in the sense that it's that was sort of a problem I had. Why would I say that it was queer or not queer? But there's something going on with erotics in the Wolfman that is important. And I don't really know why I kind of thought that Levi-Strauss could help me answer that question. And I'm not sure that he did, but I've kind of forgotten what your question was here, Jordan. Sorry.
No, I wanted to hear a bit about, yeah, what prompts the engagement with the Wolfman. And as you were saying, there's this whole, one of the things that's so, you know, difficult about reading that case study today is the kind of obsessive efforts that Freud makes, right, to try and prove the reality of the events of the primal scene. And it's somewhat maddening when you read it, at least in my experience of it, at least. So I wonder, where do you kind of sit on that? What do you make of Freud's attempt to prove the reality of the primal scene?
I guess, yeah, that's fun. I'm not sure. I think Freud is just always kind of sort of a little bit maddening in what he's trying to do. He's just a rigorous fellow. And he takes things beautifully seriously. So I guess that would be sort of what I would say in a slightly flippant fashion, that here again, he's at work in his Freud kind of way to sort of be like, I am working through this, and we sort of experience his working through of it in his writing, in his not knowing.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, does structuralism relieve us of the need to kind of posit the event as kind of a factual moment in history? Is there another way of looking at it through what you get from Levi-Strauss, or not necessarily?
Ah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah, I like that idea that structuralism itself could be part of what relieves us of the need to kind of locate this in factual reality. That's kind of, you know, what Levi-Strauss himself says at some point in that essay on the Song of Childbirth, that it's kind of just really of no interest to him whether or not these things can be located in reality. What's important is sort of is the construction or and the experience.
Yeah. Actually, could you tell us a bit? I mean, it's a that's a really beautiful Levi-Strauss paper, The Effectiveness of Symbols, that you talk about in the book. Could you explain a bit what that paper is about and what that song, what goes on in that song?
So that paper is about Levi-Strauss's reading of this, what's called the Song of Mulegla, and which is the song of this woman who's experiencing a difficult childbirth. And in the song, what happens is that a shaman is called to sort of help this woman sort of get through the pain that she's experiencing with childbirth by way of the shaman kind of going in and doing battle with what's inside the woman's body that has not been able to be expressed. So the song, as Levi-Strauss quotes it, seems to be just beautiful. But Levi-Strauss's argument is that this woman is treated because she is a part of a culture that believes in the mythology that the song itself is kind of calling upon to give an account of what she is experiencing in her body. And she's able to be cured of the pains she is experiencing because of the effectiveness of symbols, because she believes in the symbols that the shaman in the song is calling forth to sort of name what is happening to her, and that because she believes, she's able to kind of, you know, be cured. And so he uses that, as I understand it, as a way to sort of argue for the existence of a collective unconscious. I'm not totally sure how we get from A to B there, but the fact that I guess these symbols work is to his mind because they are somehow touching upon something that exists in a collective unconscious. They manage to kind of activate those powers. That's how I interpret that essay by Levi-Strauss, which is, I think, yes, ultimately just a really beautiful piece of writing.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of implications do you think it has for us today? I mean, because I guess a slightly rash kind of secularist answer would be like, well, we don't live in these times anymore where we believe in these kinds of creatures. So what use does this have to me now?
I guess I kind of correlate it to, again, the Babadook, right? Like, you might say that we sort of do live in a time where we have these kinds of answers, in as much as we still live in a time of kind of collectively held myths about, for example, like the efficacy of psychotropic medications. You know, like that's a kind of collectively held myth. But these things work. And so if you believe in that language, then that might help. That might help in the cure. Or, you know, a myth of sort of a collectively held idea we might have for Amelia, the character from the Babadook, is that it makes sense that she would be traumatized by the death of her husband. And, you know, there's things like grief work that she can do to kind of like process that experience and find words for it that are kind of familiar words that other people might share with her, and thereby she could kind of re-enter the collective through the ways in which we talk about loss and grieving.
This brings up the really kind of one of the crucial questions, which I remember, I believe you pose in the book as well, which is that the question of is the psychoanalyst then just a contemporary shaman, or is a psychoanalyst doing something different?
And that's Levi Strauss's point. Yeah, he believes that the analyst is a contemporary shaman or shaman. And I would say that at least the way I'm understanding the work of the analyst, as I've been trying to learn about it through the teachings at G-Freak, would be that the analyst cannot be a shaman because the analyst can't supply the words for what can't be said. So the analyst doesn't know what is out of language for the analysand, and that's from whence his desire to know, right? So the analyst is not someone who can give the analysand words like the shaman in this song, right, supposedly supplies the language to express what has been heretofore inexpressible. So yeah.
So the shaman has a place in solving this kind of problem, but there might be a different function that an analyst would have. Is that?
And it would be kind of a different kind of function for a different kind of problem in a way. It's kind of like if the problem can be treated with words that exist in language and in culture, good, you know, like that's also a problem,
right?
Like then we can manage that problem, and those problems deserve our attention too.
Yeah, it makes me think like, well, you know, if you just got in like a small argument with your colleague or something, then maybe you should just draw on the resources of culture to deal with it. But if you really want to question the, you know, the depths of your being and how, you know, what transference has to do in your early childhood experiences with that argument, then you have to go for a deeper treatment.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I like that. Yeah, you have to go somewhere else. And it takes you to a different place then, and you find yourself on a different scene altogether. Yeah.
Yeah, which makes it sound like that there might be times when you really don't necessarily want to be taken to a different place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really liked, I talked about it briefly in the book, that documentary, A Rendezvous with Chez Lacan, where who is it? It's the brother of Miller, Jacqueline Miller, who's talking about something. He remembers Lacan saying about like who should do an analysis, or and it's like maybe you don't, you know, you don't necessarily, you cannot unopen the box, as they say. So
let's talk a bit about the final chapter before we finish. We kind of discussed it a bit at the beginning by talking about your work on the formulas of sexuation, but there's a really interesting kind of extended discussion you have on the idea of feminine jouissance. Could you say a bit about that topic? I'm sure for some of the listeners won't necessarily be familiar with this concept of Lacan's and its significance.
Yeah, there I think I'm sort of talking about it in terms of how Lacan presents it in Seminar 20, and this kind of jouissance that is other, feminine, the other jouissance. And I guess the other, in part, it's a comparison with like phallic jouissance, which is like a jouissance that you could say is sort of takes place in language and can be talked about, and I think he calls it stupid somewhere. The other jouissance, I mean, for me, the words that just jump to mind right away again are Lily Apollon's. It's the jouissance that is too much, and it's kind of jouissance, I guess, that is you could describe it therefore as traumatizing, or it's trauma, but or like Lacan says, trauma or exquisite pleasure. So the feminine jouissance that comes up in Seminar 20, I guess, is sort of part of Lacan's attempt to sort of talk about what's happening in sexual difference. You know, why is it that there are these different experiences of jouissance? And what is it that's going on in the figure he gives is the statue of Saint Teresa. She's experiencing something, but she can't say anything about it. it's feminine jouissance, but you just have to look at her and you can see that that's what's going on.
And mm-hmm. I mean, this, I always struggle with this question, but is your take on it, I mean, that a subject kind of is positioned on one side or the other, either experiences phallic jouissance or has the potential to experience feminine jouissance, but it's kind of, you get fixed in one position or the other, and that's kind of the trajectory? Or is there some, do you see it as more ambiguous?
I think it's more ambiguous. Yeah, I think that, I mean, I might have felt differently about it, for example, when I wrote that article a long time ago where I was trying to talk about the logic of sexual difference. I think now I would say that, you know, everyone experiences feminine jouissance.
Hmm. Yeah, because I am not surprised to hear you say that in a way, because it seems like what the book, if I'm reading this right, is suggesting is that there's kind of some clinical implications about what you talk a little bit about, a clinic that isn't just about stopping or draining jouissance or symbolizing it, that there needs to be some space for working with jouissance. Is that right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It wouldn't necessarily, yeah, that we don't want to treat it or get rid of it or cure it. Uh-huh. But perhaps to find some signifiers for it.
And I guess what one other kind of complicated topic in this whole sort of knot of interesting kind of relations that you're exploring throughout the book is psychosis, of course. So I think you ask yourself, why am I talking about femininity and psychosis in the same vein, or why am I putting them into relation? So could you explain a bit about what is related about those two phenomena?
Yeah, I think it is kind of, it remains an open question for me, but my sense is that it has something to do with this relation to a limit. So they're not the same thing, but they're linked in as much as they are both kinds of ways of encountering a lack of a limit in language, femininity and psychosis. So, you know, for Lacan, the psychotic is the subject who forecloses the name of the father. The analysts at G-Freak talk about sort of the name of the father as something that is essential for the child, but only for the child. Hmm. And precisely to kind of protect the child from what is out of language, to give the child some sort of support for the fact that there is an out of language while the child is still a child. And if the child doesn't kind of have that experience, then the child is exposed too soon to the fact that there is an out of language that is traumatizing. Mm. But we all get exposed to that is how I understand the analysts at G-Freak talk about it. We all get exposed to that fact as adolescents. We all come to have to deal with that.
So it's kind of the name of the father, and the way you're talking about it is like a sort of a temporary solution.
Yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. That's what I'm understanding that the folks at G-Freak are teaching. And I think that I like that. That makes sense to me.
So then what, so if that kind of is operative, the name of the father, at least temporarily, what are the implications for femininity, or what what's the difference in a way between femininity and psychosis? You've said a little bit about how they're related, but what makes them distinct?
Well, one major difference would be that, just even kind of terminologically, but usefully, right, that psychosis is a structure. So it's a kind of a subjective structure that one then, I guess, is or can take, whereas femininity is an experience that I think, you know, is universal, that we all have. So that there's that, first of all, but that they're linked again, I think, in this experience of the lack of a limit. Does that make sense?
I mean, if I kind of read it correctly, it seems in part what's going on with the entire book is talking about a kind of a treatment that is attuned to these logic of femininity. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of trying to imagine. Yeah, that I guess ultimately such a treatment, and in as much as my own, you know, like, I'm a social worker and who's a former academic. So like the first part of the book is sort of like, does structuralism show us something about how to be attuned to femininity, or does it give us instances of this femininity? And then, yes, what would be such a treatment that was also attuned to it?
Yeah. Do you feel like you're able to apply kind of some of the insights that you've gained in writing this book to your work as a social worker?
I think that in as much as it's so important to me, like inevitably I kind of am listening to people with these things in mind. I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say that I'm applying it, because I'm not, you know, I'm not certainly not an analyst, and I'm not working therefore analytically with people. I'm a therapist, and that's different. And so, but for me, it's true. Like all of these things are kind of present within me and in my mind, and it impacts how I listen to people, if not then how I, and to a certain extent, how I would intervene with them, but still within my role as a therapist, which is quite different.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time, so I think that's it's a good place to start to wrap up. I think the last question that we always ask on the program is, what are you working on next?
Oh, that's great. I have this like fantasy of writing a book about like Marguerite Barrette. She was this, it's so funny, right, how you go back to where you came from, but like this French medieval mystic who I really enjoyed reading when I was a graduate student. So maybe I'll go back to her one day. These days, I'm really just kind of working on learning how to function as a therapist and things like gardening. So that's kind of like, it's hard to do in January, of course, in Minnesota, but...
Great. Well, fantastic. It's been so nice to speak to you, Shana, and thanks so much for offering us your time.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm really happy to get to talk with you and to appreciate your questions. They're very, you know, very helpful for me.